Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, December 8th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, "Hospital Officials Still Avoiding Transferring Patients," by Stuart Doreen. After about 9 months of COVID-19 in the community, Midland health officials are learning to expect the unexpected. The latest spike in cases has been the toughest test. Here are the statistics as of late last week. Nearly 90% of the COVID rooms, critical care, and medical units are occupied, including 94% of the 72 beds in the medical ward. That is higher than the seven-day average, 87%. This isn't a result of transfers. Midland health officials said last week that transfer requests are rarely accepted. Midland Memorial Hospital has refused around 70 requests, including 78% of requests from smaller hospitals, officials said. The patient population is around 25%, but those are generally people who have come to Midland Memorial on their own. Still, the increased COVID patients have made an impact. Of the 291 inpatient rooms, 242, or 83%, have been occupied. That is greater than the seven-day average, 78%. A FEMA tent has been erected for emergency department patients should the emergency department rooms be needed for COVID-19 patients. Also, the new ninth-floor rooms are available after an accelerated construction schedule. Midland Health CEO Russell Myers said the newest 12 beds on the floor of the North Wing, also known as the Hook, are still available. "We've gotten support from the state and from FEMA of both equipment and personnel, so we continue to push out that maximum," Myers said. "We have been pretty close to the limits on critical care capacity several times, but we're probably 20 or 25 patients away from even exhausting our existing resources. After that, we have more creative ideas that we can potentially use, redeploying recovery rooms and other well-equipped patient care environments that are not intended for inpatients but can be repurposed in the short run for a little while to hold the patient before they can be moved into the appropriate bed. We've got ER capacity to hold patients for a while as well. The tent we put on site supplements that and makes it easier to hold people there. So I think we're still a good distance from being at a point that we cannot come up with another solution internally, because transferring patients is a lot easier said than done." Myers said, "Areas that Midland Memorial typically transfers to are having their own issues with COVID right now. For example, the Department of State Health Services was showing on Friday the percentage of COVID patients in the Lubbock region was running about 85% higher than the number in the Midland-Odessa region. Percentages in the Abilene and Dallas-Fort Worth regions have been higher than the 15% mark required to trigger more state restrictions. Transferring is never going to be a good solution for us," Myers said. "We're going to do everything possible not to let that happen." This article is entitled, "Interim MISD Superintendent's New Calendar, All About Academics. Included are weeks to help struggling students catch up," by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD Interim Superintendent Ann Dixon has insisted that academic improvement would be a focus during her limited time with the district. Last week, she provided more evidence of that. Dixon told the school board during a workshop that she will introduce a school calendar for the 2021-22 year that includes more instructional days and also include weeks within the school year and afterward to help students who have fallen behind on reading. It is part of a nearly singular focus that Dixon has had since her arrival in Midland. She has been vocal about wanting to put a spotlight on the ability of students to read at or beyond grade level. During the workshop, Dixon and other district leaders told the board how behind students had become and what the goals were for the next 3 years. Second graders were showing a beginning of the year score of 56. the percentage reading at or beyond grade level. The percentage of 8th graders was 36%. That is just more than one-third reading at or above grade level. Dixon previously told the Reporter Telegram about the lack of comments she has received from community members who wanted to see academic improvement, specifically reading. Still, during her short time at MISD, district officials have created a literacy tutor program that has more than 60 people willing to work with students on their reading. The calendar is another step in rebuilding a reading revolution, Dixon said. Her proposed calendar is expected to include weeks off in the fall and spring that will include weeks of intervention for students who need help with reading. During her discussion with the board, Dixon said the calendar will include a week in the fall, another in the spring, and up to 20 days in the summer. Students would go to school for half days for an intensive reading program. If a parent opted a student out of the program and the student did not reach a certain reading level, the student would not advance to the next grade. Teachers wanting to be part of the program would be offered, quote, premium pay, unquote, for their service. Dixon explained the program's salary structure would be consistent with the salary structure of the district's most veteran teachers. The program would be open to current teachers, retired teachers, and even some whose careers have taken them to the central office. She told the board that the program requires having the best reading teachers in front of students. Her plan is to have no more than 10 students in a class. Dixon told the board that the district needs a unified reading program, one every campus follows, and that central office supports. She said having a different campuses using different programs limits the support that can be offered by not only central office, but teachers from other campuses. Dixon's one hope for the program is that it was phonics-based. She said there is the talent within the teaching ranks, campus leadership, and even in central office to pick the best program to ultimately follow. This is the news page. This article is entitled, Number of COVID Cases Tops 11,000, from Staff Reports. It took 1 week to add another 1,000 COVID cases to the total for December. The Midland Health Department reported 1 week after the 10,000 COVID-19 patient inside Midland County that the 11,000 barrier had been cleared. The Health Department reported that as of Monday, the number of cases is 11,079. The City of Midland reported another 187 unconfirmed cases were added from Friday through Sunday. Unconfirmed cases are reflective of the number of positive test results received from testing locations. On Monday, the Health Department also reported 178 confirmed cases on November 17th. Bringing the total number of confirmed cases in Midland County to 8,564. Between November 18th and December 6th, there have been 2,515 cases still waiting to be confirmed. Due to the number of cases received each day, the staff is contacting positive cases and contacts from November 18th, the city reported. The patients have been notified by the testing location of the results. However, the patients have not been contacted by the Midland Health Department yet to confirm residency, gather their close contacts, or to advise them on guidelines. The information is being released to the public in an effort to provide citizens more insight into how the virus is affecting our community on a daily basis. The Health Department also reported there are 2,465 active cases in Midland County and 5,645 people have recovered. There were no reports of COVID-19 deaths on Monday, so the death count remains at 155.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, December 8, 2020. Centennial Park. Centennial Park, 200 West Wall Street, offers many different features, including tables and chairs and a fountain. High Sky Wing to host Christmas Lights Flights. The Commemorative Air Force's High Sky Wing is hosting the 7th Annual Christmas Lights Night Flights Friday through December 23. Flights on C-45 Spirit of West Texas are scheduled every 30 minutes beginning at 6 p.m. The last flight is at 9:30 p.m. Flights depart from the CAF High Sky Wing Hangar at Midland International Air and Spaceport. Tickets are $75 a person, 4 seats per flight, $145 for the co-pilot seat, and $395 for all 5 seats, according to High Sky's website. Riders must be 5 years or older. All children under 12 must be accompanied by an adult. Passengers must be able to enter and exit the aircraft under their own mobility. To book a flight, email rides@highskywing.org or text 254-6182. Include phone number, requested dates, and time and number of seats needed. The Midland Army Airfield Museum will be open to tour during the flights, and there will be complimentary hot chocolate and cookies. Landgraf at Leadership Lunch. The Midland Liberty Leadership Council will host State Representative Brooks Landgraf of Odessa at its luncheon Wednesday for a presentation on the upcoming session of the Texas Legislature. The luncheon is set for 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Gerardo's Casita, 2407 North Big Spring Street. The Midland Liberty Leadership Council is a group for young professionals between the ages of 21 and 40 who are looking to get involved in conservative public policy. The group is sponsored by the Texas Public Policy Foundation, a nonprofit free market research institute based in Austin. Please RSVP for a free ticket by visiting TPPF's Liberty Leadership Council event page at midlandllc-lunch.eventbrite.com. Gas prices in Midland. Midland-Odessa gas prices are unchanged in the past week, averaging $1.93 a gallon Monday, according to Gas Buddy's daily survey of 156 stations. Gas prices in Midland-Odessa are 2 cents per gallon higher than a month ago and stand 50.6 cents per gallon lower than a year ago. The following are prices in Midland-Odessa on December 7, going back 10 years. 2019, $2.44 a gallon. 2018, $2.65 a gallon. 2017, $2.50 a gallon. 2016, $1.99 a gallon. 2015, $1.87 a gallon. 2014, $2.54 a gallon. 2013, $3.07 a gallon. 2012, $3.29 a gallon. 2011, $3.24 a gallon. 2010, $2.88 a gallon. Source, GasBuddy.com. December 15 election. MISD and City of Odessa runoffs. Early voting times, today and Wednesday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Thursday and Friday, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Early voting location, Elections Office, County Annex Building, 2110 North A Street. Early voting numbers, November 30 through December 4, in person, 204, ballot by mail, 312, total, 516. Note, there was a total of 522 votes during early voting and on Election Day during the city's special election earlier this year. Parade organizers seek participants. Organizers of the Drive-Thru Holiday Parade are looking for businesses, organizations, or individuals to participate in the event planned for 6 to 9 p.m. December 19 at the Horseshoe parking lot. The Midland County Public Library and Midland County Sheriff's Office are hosting the event that will allow spectators to view stationary parade floats from their vehicles. Parade participants will remain with their float and not gather with others during the event, according to a press release from the county. Traffic will be restricted to one way only, with spectators entering the parking lot from Garfield Street and exiting onto the Interstate 20 service road. Those interested in decorating a float or vehicle for the parade should contact Hannah Johnson at hjohnson@mcounty.com or MCSO Sergeant Edie Subia at esubia@mcounty.com. Today in history. Today is Tuesday, December 8th, the 343rd day of 2020. There are 23 days left in the year. Today's highlight. On December 8, 1941, the United States entered World War II as Congress declared war against Imperial Japan, a day after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Source, AP.
This is the opinion page. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled An Election That Really, Really Counts by J. Ambrose, Tribune News Service. The future of America has come down to Georgia, with the possibility of two Democrats getting elected to the U.S. Senate in early January if the Republicans keep lending a hand. That will mean a one-party, autocratically inspired, socialistically tantalized government saying shut up if you believe in liberty and goodbye to the economy. President Joe Biden could be denied use of his negotiating skills, except possibly ineffective attempts with stare him down comrades. Just the other day, by way of messing up, President Donald Trump allegedly said in a private meeting, no more private than usual, that he thought members of the recently arisen politically active group QAnon believe in good government. That may be true, but hardly overrides their more advertised belief in Satan worshiping, pedophilic federal bureaucrats dictating stuff they must defeat. More nearly in this world, tough Trump ally Republican Senator Lindsey Graham is said to have asked Georgia's Secretary of State about his ability to get rid of some class or the other of absentee ballots. Not a righteous-sounding query, whatever he meant. Then there's this attorney who is encouraging Republican voters in the state that cheats them to forget voting, because that would be as sure as anything to teach the Democrats a lesson. It is hard to know what lesson he has in mind, but it's a good guess the Democrats might learn he is worth a payroll position. One thing the Republicans have going for them is that the polls contend the two Democrats in the runoff race are ahead, and that, as we all know, pollsters are getting better at making mistakes. It is important because, in all seriousness, if the Democrats control both Congress and the presidency, they can follow through on packing the Supreme Court, ending the Senate filibuster, exploding the debt, raising corporate taxes to the point of limp-along production, committing more Middle East mistakes, and destroying our suburbs. Watch out for this last item, because President-elect Biden does favor something akin to a federal takeover of suburbs, building apartment houses and business districts, and restricting car use. He also favors raising taxes to pay for maybe half of his spending ambitions. He seems to have a cooler, more centrist head on many issues than ever cheerier leftist Democrats. But will they be able to force him where he does not want to go? We are right now in a scary political period where old norms seem disposable if they get in the way of central planners who know better how to lead your life than you do. President Trump may have inadvertently boosted this cause with his obsession, as in not giving up on overturning a presidential election, staying put, and his Twitter mentality. But he has also been an example of how the Democratic cause can be abused, as in the constant, egregious, illegitimate attempts to push him out of office. He has performed well in a variety of ways, as in deregulation that helped us make us energy independent. Democrats love regulations, and President Barack Obama set a record in the number of major ones, especially established during his administration. If Democrats win Georgia, those regulations will likely come back. New ones will join them, and we may be further enmeshed in what Alexis de Tocqueville warned about in his 19th century work, Democracy in America. Not outright tyranny, but a grinning imitation. He imagined a governmental force that speaks for a majority as it, quote, hinders, compromises, enervates, extinguishes, dazes, and finally reduces, unquote, Americans to a herd of timid animals. In this case, it might be at its worst for only 2 years, with the Republicans regaining congressional control in the next election. And right now we are learning if money talks. Spending on both sides has gone crazy, even though those who spend the most are not necessarily the winners. This column is entitled, Getting the Vaccine is a Civic Duty, by Kathleen Parker, Washington Post Writers Group. The vaccine that will save us already promises to complicate our lives in countless unfathomable ways. With tens of billions fewer doses available than needed, at least for starters, the notion of a vaccine lottery intrudes upon happier thoughts. Who gets a vaccine? Who doesn't? Who decides? Who do governments deem is more or less deserving of the supposed preventive, at least at the start? In the United States, an advisory committee of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is already trying to answer such questions. On Tuesday, the panel said healthcare workers and long-term care residents and staff should get priority treatment. First responders should be next. But who's next in line? Older Americans, more generally, perhaps, however older is defined, and then people with pre-existing conditions such as diabetes, heart and respiratory conditions, and other diseases that would likely place a person at higher risk. Perhaps I read too much science fiction in my youth, but I see a lot of potential for this new world of vaccine sorting to go down poorly with the public. We are already living in a world gone scared. Add to it now a cure in, for the moment, short supply. Can we as humans remain calm and wait our turn? I am not sure. I keep imagining the Titanic. Which passengers got lifeboat seats and which were left to their own resources? Women, children, and the elderly got first dibs. Men, ever chivalrous and valiant, stayed behind to bravely face their doom. In the movie version, some rich person steals a baby to earn himself a lifeboat seat. So, if the vaccine could save us, it will also reveal our truest selves. If people with pre-existing conditions get an early place in line, should that include smokers or other people who have diseases aggravated by poor lifestyle choices? They are surely more at risk than healthy people. Will people with borderline conditions insist on special treatment? And then there is the question of whether to require the vaccine. In the broad interest of the public, for as many people as possible to develop immunity from the virus. But what if a healthy 30-year-old doesn't want to be injected with a little bit of the virus? Can she be forced? It is already clear that many people from across the spectrum are suspicious of a government-organized vaccination program. There are also questions about our relationship with our employers. Can they force us to get a vaccine? Is that a reasonable condition of employment? While most Americans are relieved to hear that a vaccine is coming, many of us may be disappointed to hear that our turns won't come until next spring or perhaps later, even if all goes well. What recourse will be available to those who feel they've been left behind? So, news of the vaccine is cause for celebration, or at least relief. But the more one thinks about the mind-bending logistical challenges and extrapolates to a variety of possible scenarios, even the best champagne begins to lose its bubble. I'm probably no different than most people. I've developed late-onset asthma and tend toward pulmonary inflammation at the drop of a dust mite. After years of getting an annual flu shot, this year's version put me to bed for a few hours. Am I scared? No, I'm not, except of the virus, and so I look forward to getting the shots when my turn comes. Philosophically, I think the vaccine may fall under the category of civic duty. In a sense, we are inoculating ourselves for each other. This, apparently, is how former Presidents Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama are treating the question. In an act of civic heroism, the three have volunteered to receive the vaccine publicly in an attempt to ease public fears. President-elect Joe Biden said he'll do the same as soon as doctors give him a green light. He says he also plans to ask all Americans to wear a mask during the first 100 days of his administration and will make mask wearing mandatory in federal buildings and on public transportation. All things considered, it's a small ask. What's another 100 days compared to another year like the one coming to a close? If the outgoing president, whose name escapes me, had asked the same of us rather than making a mockery of the suffering and sacrifice of so many Americans, we might be having a very different conversation. This is the obituary column, Tuesday, December 8th. Dora Jean Sanderford. Dora Jean McDonald Sanderford of Midland, Texas, devoted follower of Christ, beloved wife, mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, went to her heavenly reward on December 3rd. A visitation will begin at 6 p.m. on Thursday, December 10th at Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland. Services will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, December 12th at Wilkerson Hatch Bailey Funeral Home in Waco. Interment will follow at Waco Memorial Park. Dora Sanderford was born at home on April 6, 1925, in the Antelope community of Coryell County, Texas, to Nathan and Isabel McDonald. Dora is survived by her four children, Matthew A. Sanderford Jr. and wife Margarita of Weatherford, Sharon Jean Cummings and husband Larry of Round Rock, Lee Bell Ulvestad and husband Greg of Midland, John Mark Sanderford and wife Susan of Midland. She is also survived by 10 grandchildren, 23 great-grandchildren, one great-great-grandchild, and numerous nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her husband of 60 years, Matthew A. Sanderford, her parents, all of her brothers and sisters, and one grandchild. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the Lottie Moon Christmas offering in care of Wilshire Park Baptist Church, 801 South Bentwood, Midland, Texas, 79703. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Elicio Larez Robledo. Elicio Che Larez Robledo, 57, of Midland, Texas, was received with open arms by our Heavenly Father and once again, as when he was born, into the arms of his parents, Jesus Quiriqui Robledo and Tomasa Larez Robledo, on November 17th after his toughest battle with COVID. Due to COVID, funeral services will be announced at a later date. Helen June Parker Burris. June 24, 1931 to December 4, 2020. June Burris, 89, a longtime resident of Dallas, Texas, and in recent years, Forney and Midland, Texas, passed away on Friday, December 4th. The family will receive friends on Monday, December 7th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home in Midland. A funeral service will be held Tuesday, December 8th at 2 p.m. at Nally Pickle and Wells Chapel, with her son-in-law David Hill officiating and her grandson Aaron Hill providing music. A live stream of the service will be available at www.npwelch.com. A graveside service will be held on Thursday, December 10th at 2 p.m. at Rose Hill Cemetery in Pittsburgh, Texas. June was born June 24, 1931, to Eddie Mae Carpenter and K.J. Parker in Pittsburgh, Texas. She is survived by her husband of 68 years, George Burris of Midland, daughter Linda Hill and husband David of Midland, son Scott Burris and wife Christy of Forney, and son-in-law Michael Weaver of Pittsburgh, Texas. She is preceded in death by her daughter Melody Weaver. She is also survived by 8 grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren. Her survivors also include her sister Wanda Browder of Dallas, an aunt, and numerous nieces, nephews, and cousins. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Judith Ann Rhodes Coleman. With profound sadness, we announce the passing of Judy Ann Rhodes Coleman, our loving and devoted mother and friend to all whose lives she touched, on December 1st. She was 81 years young. Judy was born March 10, 1939, in Bristow, Oklahoma, to L.Z. and Zula Rhodes. She is preceded in death by her parents, husband Jim Coleman, one son Timothy Coleman, and one brother David Rhodes. She is survived by one brother, George Ronald Rhodes of Amarillo, her daughter Tanya Carroll and son-in-law David of Midland,
her son Jeffrey Coleman and daughter-in-law Jennifer of Staunton, Virginia, her daughter-in-law Michelle Coleman of Midland, and her five grandchildren. The family has decided to forgo a memorial service at this time for the safety of family and friends. Judy will be laid to rest at Trinity Memorial Park in Big Spring, Texas. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the Alzheimer's Association. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Kenny Taylor. Kenny Taylor was born in Odessa, Texas. His parents were James and Cindy Brunson and Sherry Taylor Brunson. Kenny Taylor is survived by his beloved wife, Casey Taylor, and children Samantha Harris, Kennedy and Reese Taylor, Ricky Benton, Kirkland and Brady Newsom, and granddaughter Riker Plymo and brother Chris Taylor and nephew Christian Taylor. Donations for the family of Kenny Taylor can be made to the Ector County Sheriff's Department, P.O. Box 2066, Odessa, Texas, 79760. Phone number 432-335-3050. Flowers for the service can be given to Crossroads Church or Sunset Gardens for the services. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. To send family condolences, please sign his guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. Richard Dick Paul Bledsoe. Richard Dick Paul Bledsoe was born on September 24, 1938, in Ardmore, Oklahoma, to Dell and Glenna Ryan Bledsoe. Dick went to be with his Lord and Savior on November 27, 2020. Dick was preceded in death by his parents and brother Jack Bledsoe, in-laws Orrin and Melba Fisher, and one sister-in-law, Janie Brown. Dick is survived by his wife of 47 years, Anne. He is also survived by Brian and his wife, Jane, and Chris and his wife, Summer. Granddad's favorite loved ones were his four grandkids. He is survived by two special blessings from God, Antonia Baskus and her husband, Nick, and their children, and Keandra Proctor. He is survived by other relatives, including one sister-in-law, Carmelita Tipton of Oklahoma City, and her brother and her husband, Ben, brother-in-law and sister-in-law, Robert and Kay Tidwell of Gilmer, Texas, and brother-in-law, Nolan Brown of Canyon, Texas. He also has numerous nieces and nephews. There will be a graveside service December 9th at 1 p.m. at Rest Haven Memorial Cemetery, and memorial service may be planned at a later date. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests memorials be made through Calvary Assembly of God, 908 South Johnston, Midland, Texas, 79701. The suggested memorials are Pleasant Hills Children's Home, the Assemblies of God Fire Bible Project, or Teen Challenge of the Permian Basin. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Sarah Lou Link Grimes. Sarah Lou Link Grimes of Midland, Texas, passed away Thursday, December 3rd, at home surrounded by those that loved her most. Sarah Lou's birth in Midland on June 12, 1932, to Louis Charles Link and Sarah Ann Binney Link completed the family. Sarah Lou is survived by husband David, daughter Amy Grimes Ehrlich, and husband Bob of Austin, son David Link Grimes and wife Missy of Midland, and daughter Sarah Ann Grimes and husband Jay Old of Austin, as well as 11 grandchildren and many nieces and nephews. She is preceded in death by her husbands Sarah and L.C. Link, her sister and husband Francis and Jack Matthews, and by sister-in-law and husband Francie and Michael Alt, and nephews John Grimes and David Alt. There will be a private graveside service at Rest Haven Memorial Park with Pastor Steve Shore officiating on Wednesday, December 9th. There will be a celebration of Sarah Lou's life when we can all gather safely once more. Please consider gifts to Hospice of Midland, the Lynn Scholarship Fund at the First Presbyterian Church, or other charities of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Terry Mickley Hall. On November 5th, 2020, Terry Mickley Hall passed away in Midland. Terry was born on October 20th, 1947, in Houston. She is preceded in death by her parents, Lou and Maggie Mickley, and her brother, Pat Mickley. She is survived by her husband, Guy Paul Hall, son, Alan Hall, daughter, Natalie Hall Perez, Joe, brother, Steve Mickley, Kay, and sister, Betsy Mickley, Sheets, along with numerous nieces and nephews, whom she loved dearly. Funeral services will be held December 12th at First Presbyterian Church at 800 West Texas Avenue, Midland, Texas, 79701 at 2 p.m. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to St. Jude's Children's Hospital or Serenity House. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Death notices. Emily June Williams McBrayer. On December 4th, Emily June Williams McBrayer passed away in Midland. She is survived by her daughter, Darlene Olson Dean. There will be a private family burial and then a celebration of life service for friends and family at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory Chapel on Friday, December 11th at 3 p.m. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Gilberto Martinez. Gilberto Martinez, 48, of Andrews, passed away on December 2nd at Permian Regional Medical Center in Andrews, Texas. Gilberto was born on May 9, 1972, to Natalio and Lucilia Martinez in Andrews, Texas. He is survived by his spouse, Maria de Jesus Martinez, four children, Marcos Jimenez, Cassandra, Damian Solis Martinez, Gilberto and Hector Natalio Martinez, and Chloe Lucilia Martinez, two grandchildren, his father, Natalio Martinez, and three siblings. Visitation will be held on Monday, December 7th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home in Midland. Rosary will be held at 6 p.m. at Our Lady of Lourdes in Andrews. Funeral service will be on Tuesday, December 8th at 10 a.m. in Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church in Andrews. Burial will take place at Andrews County Cemetery North.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, December 8th, 2020. Front page. Stop the spread. Wear a mask. Protect yourself and others against COVID-19. Interest high in city races. Some frustrated at having to vote in Midland. OA News at OAOA.com. The unusual occurrence of three hot runoffs for mayor and two city council seats has Odessa voters either scrambling to early voting centers or planning a trek to election day polls on December 15th. Some citizens who live in the part of Odessa that is in Midland County, like most of those who live in Mission Dorado, had tried to vote early in Odessa, but were told they had to cast ballots in Midland. An Ector County Deputy Elections Administration clerk reported at midday Monday that about 1,730 early votes, not including mail-in ballots, had been cast, as former District 2 Councilman Dewey Bryant and Javier Hoven compete to succeed Mayor David Turner. Both Turner and Bryant have termed out of their current seats and are seeking other city offices. Turner and Denise Swanner are seeking the at-large council seat, while the District 1 race is between Mark Mata and appointed incumbent Michael K. Shelton Sr. Odessans who live in Midland County must vote early at the Midland County Annex, 2110 North A Street in Midland, or on Election Day at the Odessa Country Club. Odessans Pat Kennedy and Jean Bartley and her husband Kevin tried to vote at the County Annex office here last week, but were turned away. It was okay, Kennedy said. I had felt like that's what would happen. I went over to Midland and voted the same day. The Bartleys went to the annex late last Friday and were disappointed because we'd just assumed we could vote here because it's a city election and we live in the city, Jean Bartley said. Now I'll vote on election day, she said, adding that her husband will try to vote early in Midland because he is tied up on election day. Early voting for the runoff election is scheduled from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. through Wednesday and 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Thursday and Friday. Locations for early voting include the Ector County Courthouse Annex, the Globe Theater at Odessa College, Salinas Community Building, and First Church of the Nazarene Gymnasium. Westlake Hardware is not a location. City of Odessa residents who live in Midland County must vote at the Midland County Annex Courtroom, 2110 North A Street in Midland for early voting, and then at Odessa Country Club, number 1 Fairway Drive on Election Day. Election Day locations in Odessa will include the Globe Theater at Odessa College, Salinas Community Building, and First Church of the Nazarene Gymnasium. Voting hours will be 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Council will discuss group home by Federico Martinez, F-M-A-R-T-I-N-E-Z, at OAOA.com. Residents in the Northeast Odessa neighborhood of Esmond Estates are upset that the City of Odessa is allowing a men's group home for recovering drug addicts and alcoholics to begin operating, even though the facility does not comply with existing local zoning regulations. Residents are also concerned that the group home will lower property values in the neighborhood. The Odessa City Council is scheduled to discuss the issue at their 6 p.m. Tuesday meeting. City Attorney Natasha Brooks told City Council during last week's work session that federal law allows such facilities to operate in residentially zoned neighborhoods because federal regulations supersede state and local zoning ordinances. Federal law prohibits discrimination against facilities for the disabled, including drug addiction, said Brooks, who argued that no residents complained when the group home began operating 3 months ago. We have received not calls regarding We have received no calls regarding this address. Brooks' comments raised the ire of residents, who said the city never informed residents of the group home plans. That's bull blank, said Gary Wynn, who lives across the street from the group home. City officials never told anybody in the neighborhood about this. We didn't learn about it until we started seeing cars and motorcycles pulling up to the group home at all times of the day and night. People just pull up, pass bags of something to residents who hand them something in return. There's always a long line of cars and motorcycles coming and going. If I wanted to sell my house and someone stopped by to look at it and saw what was going on, there's no way they would want to live here. Wynn and other residents say there has been an increase in burglaries in the neighborhood since the group home began operating. Brooks and other city administrators say they are not aware of any increased crime in the area. Several council members expressed concern that residents were never notified in advance of the group home. They also wondered why council was never told about the operation. Brooks said that residents and council weren't notified because no rezoning was required. Straight Line, which the group home is called, is housed in a home that has been renovated into a 5-bedroom home and can house up to 8 to 10 men at a time. The house was originally built as a 3-bedroom. Simon Cross, who represents the group home, said the facility has a zero-tolerance policy, meaning that if any residents are caught using or selling drugs, they are immediately kicked out of the program. Cross did not tell council members if anyone has violated the policy. The group home also conducts random drug tests on residents, he added. Cross acknowledged that the facility has prompted more traffic to the neighborhood. Many of the group home residents also have vehicles, which has made parking more difficult. We want to be transparent and be good neighbors with the city and neighborhood, Cross said. Landgraf bill aims to curb emergency rules, by Ruth Campbell, R-C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L at OAOA.com. Austin. State Representative Brooks Landgraf has filed House Bill 665 to require state agencies to obtain legislative approval to renew emergency rules adopted during a state of disaster, such as hospital visitation restrictions that have been imposed recently. Landgraf said in a phone interview that his legislation has to do with the longevity of the emergency rule. The emergency rule can still be in place, but it limits the effectiveness for 30 days, Landgraf said. It can be renewed again under my proposal for 60 days at a time, but that renewal has to be approved, basically, by at least a small group of legislators. The committee members have jurisdiction over that state agency, so it's just a way to bring more accountability to the process so that the people can have more of a say rather than just leaving the authority to make these decisions in the hands of unelected bureaucrats for an indefinite period of time. In March of this year, the Texas Health and Human Services Commission adopted an emergency rule that required hospitals to prohibit visitors who were not providing critical assistance. Current law allows state agencies to adopt emergency rules without prior notice or hearing if the agency finds that there is imminent peril to public health or safety. Such rules can be effective for 120 days and can be renewed once for 60 days. This proved to be untenable for thousands of Texans who were prevented from visiting family in hospitals throughout the state in 2020. The policy that locked them out was not a law adopted by an elected body or even an executive order issued by the governor. It was a decision made behind closed doors by an unelected bureaucracy, Landgraf stated. House Bill 665, if passed, will ensure there is sufficient public oversight over state agencies during times of disaster in Texas so that this sort of thing never happens again. Dr. Rohit Sarvanan, Chief Medical Officer at Odessa Regional Medical Center and Scenic Mountain Medical Center, said in a statement that any visitor policy is a fine balance between patient safety and satisfaction. We value patient safety, and it is a known fact that bedside family caregiver presence improves patient care. During this pandemic, we have had to make some tough choices about our visitor policy. A stringent no-visitor policy is almost required when you have rampant spread of an infectious disease for the protection of our patients, staff, and the community at large. In addition, the conservation of PPE, personal protective equipment, adds an extra layer of complexity to this decision. We are in support of transparency and oversight of the committees that make these recommendations, and we also support the public health mitigation efforts that expert panels take in the face of a pandemic to protect our community, Sarvanan stated. Landgraf, an Odessa Republican, said in a news release that he had heard too many tragic and sad stories from Texans who were prevented from being with their loved ones in a hospital during their final moments. I advocated for our local physicians and hospital administrators to be able to have the flexibility to be able to implement their own visitation rules based on the prevalence of the coronavirus in their area. However, there was little I could do because the current law allowed a state bureaucracy to adopt a one-size-fits-all approach for the entire state without any legislative oversight or public input whatsoever. HB 665 will change that, he said. Landgraf said he thinks there are going to be a number of reforms along these lines. I expect this to get quite a bit of attention because this is obviously pandemic-related. That's going to be a big focus of this upcoming legislative session, he said. I think that there is an appetite, not only in the legislature, but among the people of Texas, to have more transparency and more accountability in the way that we as a state deal with these public health crises, and I think this helps that. Without sacrificing safety, we can still have these protective measures in place, but I think it's important to do so in a way that ensures that we have some degree of accountability, Landgraf said. To be clear, the full legislature wouldn't have to be in session for this approval to be given. It just requires a vote of a joint hearing of the standing committees of both the House and the Senate that can be done without the legislature being in session. It doesn't specify the committee. The bill just states that the renewal must be approved by a majority vote of a joint hearing of the standing committees of each house of the legislature with primary jurisdiction over the state agency. It would be different committees depending on which state agency is issuing the emergency rule, Landgraf added. HB 665 specifies that during times in which the governor has declared a state of disaster for at least 75% of Texas counties, agency emergency rules can only be effective for 30 days and cannot be renewed unless approved by a majority vote of a joint hearing of the standing committees of each house of the legislature, with primary jurisdiction over the agency seeking to renew the emergency rule. The legislature convenes January 12, 2021. Members of the Texas House and Texas Senate may begin filing bills for the 2021 legislative session as early as November 9, 2020. The Texas legislature meets at the Texas Capitol Building for a 140-day regular session beginning the second Tuesday in January every odd-numbered year to vote on proposed legislation and pass a balanced state budget. Vaccine information. Texas is expecting the first batch of COVID-19 vaccines to be delivered starting December 14th. Landgraf said those will be from Pfizer. Landgraf said Texas will allocate COVID-19 vaccines, which will be in limited supply, to healthcare workers who fill a critical role caring for and preserving the lives of COVID-19 patients. Then second would be frontline workers who are at greater risk of contracting COVID-19 due to the nature of their work, which I think that one would include teachers, Landgraf said. The third category would be vulnerable populations who are at greater risk of severe disease and death if they contract COVID-19. That's followed by mitigating factors such as demographics, poverty, insurance status, and geography, he said. Christmas tree lighting. Permian Basin Rehabilitation Center poster child 5-year-old Dahlia Ramos, 5, right, is held by her mother, Marisol Fierro, under the community Christmas tree at the community Christmas tree lighting ceremony Monday at Optimist Park. Ramos, who has Williams syndrome, undergoes speech and physical therapy once a week at Permian Basin Rehab Center. Photos by Jacob Ford, Odessa American. 312 days. For 312 days, the city has fought a lawsuit brought by the Odessa American to enforce the state law that guarantees the public's right to see basic police records. Through December 4th, the city has spent $87,490.99 of taxpayers' dollars to fight releasing information on crime in Odessa. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Editor's note. Ector County will not be able to update the COVID-19 dashboard this week due to limited data entry staff. ECISD daily cases, 14 students, 14 staff. Midland County, 7,654 confirmed, 145 deaths. Texas, 1,258,214 confirmed, with 11,455,346 tested. Total Texas deaths, 22,627. U.S. cases, 14,909,148 total confirmed and 283,503 deaths. Find out more at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. See the ECISD COVID-19 dashboard at tinyurl.com/Y6NTPTUQ. Quick hits. Empty stocking needs help. With only 10 days to go in the 26th year of the Empty Stocking Fund, our goal of $100,000 won't be met without your help. Funds stay in Ector County to help needy families during the annual fundraising effort by the Odessa American and the Salvation Army. Funds go for a good holiday meal and small gifts under the tree. Donations to the Empty Stocking Fund can help families struggling through these difficult economic and COVID-19 times. Donations may be mailed or delivered to the Salvation Army Community Center, 810 East 11th Street, or the Odessa American, 700 North Grant, Suite 800. Zip codes for both are 79761. Call the Salvation Army at 332-0738. The Empty Stocking Fund was created by the Odessa American in 1995 and has raised more than $2 million. Donate online at tinyurl.com/VH5FJDZ. On the net, tinyurl.com/VH5FJDZ. From Staff Reports. Supporting the Blue. Atmos Energy recently treated the Odessa Police Department to two large boxes of muffins. Courtesy photo. Empty Stocking. Christopher Pipes, $100. Renee and Rich Earls, $150. Tony Pettit, $500. Ryan and Diana Dill, $100. Mickey Jones, $500. Today's total, $1,350. Grand total, $17,802. Goal, $100,000. Want to help? Donations to the Empty Stocking Fund may be mailed or delivered to the Odessa American, 700 North Grant, Suite 800, Odessa, or the Salvation Army Community Center, 810 East 11th Street, 79761. Donate online at tinyurl.com/VH5FJDZ. Want to know more? Call 332-0738. What is it? Empty Stocking Fund was created by the Odessa American in 1995 and has raised more than $2 million. Empty Stocking Funds enable the Salvation Army to provide toys and food baskets to needy families in Odessa. This year's goal is $100,000.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.